In this present crisis, government is not the solution to our problem. Government is the problem.
This is the I Spy Radio Show.
You and I have a rendezvous with destiny.
Keeping an eye on big government.
We the people tell the government what to do. It doesn't tell us.
The trouble with our liberal friends is not that they're ignorant. It's just that they know so much that isn't so.
And now, here is your host, Mark Anderson.
Chaos and destruction. Those are the inevitable end results of the left's solutions. Perhaps in part because they can't see it coming, or in part because it doesn't matter. They'll just use government to bail things out or change the rules to make failure look a little more successful. Or maybe they'll activate their paid activists who will demand more of the failure. Or maybe they just don't care about the end results. Only the present matters, not the future. Not the future of companies whose bottom lines they've devoured, nor of forests and the environment they've managed to save by ignoring them. It's not their money, it's not their companies, it's not their forest. Why would it matter if their policies work or spectacularly fail? In fact, there's a perverted incentive for the left's policies to fail. Oh look, we've ruined healthcare by making total costs skyrocket. We forced the system to cover more people, but we won't build any more hospitals or hire more nurses or doctors, not until it's so bad that there are no options and then you'll have to opt for our solution, which is to push socialized medicine on everyone, except for the rich. They can still get the care we've excluded everyone else from. Like public schools. Sure, they're failing. That's why we need more money. Duh. Oh, look, there's racism in corporations. They're not hiring enough minorities. Let's force them to hire more people of this color or that gender or whatever, regardless of their skills. And in fact, it's even better if race-based hires have no skills. We know they didn't learn any skills or usable knowledge in the public schools that we ran. It doesn't matter. They'll get hired because of their demographics value, and you don't need skills or expertise to be a demographic. And once they get laid off from jobs they were never qualified for anyway, then we can scream about how unfair corporations are to minorities, and we have a whole new set of victims of racism that can demand what we want them to demand. Oh look, the forest burned down. Gosh, how did that happen? We're sure it had nothing to do with ignoring the forest and letting things dry up or rot. That wasn't us. It was global warming. We need more money to protect the forest we just let burn down. And on and on. Today, we'll be looking at two solutions from the left, DEI, that's diversity, equity, and inclusion, which really means no diversity, no equity, and no inclusion, unless you're the correct demographic. By the way, have you noticed that those pushing diversity never say historically black colleges should be forced to include whites? I thought you said diversity was a good thing. Weird. And the other solution that we'll talk about today is a new plan to save the forest by not cutting timber, or allow pretty much anything else to happen there. By the way, have you seen what happens to a lawn when it's ignored and not mowed for a few months? This plan will ignore forests for 70 years. Well, when the forests burn down, which they will, I guess the good news is there will be fewer forests the state will have to manage. What a solution. To talk about DEI and its effects, I'd like to welcome Christian Watson to the show. He is a writer and political commentator, especially on the issues of free speech. He has been featured in outlets such as USA Today, Newsmax TV, BBC Radio London, The Washington Examiner, and more. He is also the national spokesman for Color Us United, and he's the host of Pensive Politics with Christian Watson. Welcome. Thanks for being here, Christian.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. So for our audience, let's define DEI. The acronym stands for Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion. But how would its promoters define it, and how would you define it?
Well, its promoters would define it as a political program that would ensure equitable outcomes for people who have, in their words, been historically marginalized by certain laws, certain social situations, and certain power structures. I would define it as a political program which attempts to butcher the meanings of words that are actually virtuous in their original form and distill it to a pseudo-Marxist kind of language that they then use to justify redistributionist and discriminatory political policies. I know that's a very long definition, but if we're going to understand these things, we have to understand them deeply.
Right.
Because you can't simply say DEI is Marxist, because that doesn't get you anywhere. It gets you nowhere. And most people don't even know what Marxist is. Most folks have an idea of what it is, and they just keep that idea and they use it to confirm things. It's good to push yourself and expand the limits of your mind so that when you do confront people who believe in these ideas, you can soundly object to them on the basis of fact and on the basis of sound reasoning.
So the promoters of it, do they say, oh, this totally isn't Marxism, or do they acknowledge that it is?
Well, a lot of them would not openly admit that it's Marxism. A lot of them would simply laugh at that assertion, and they would say that this is simply something that is being done to rectify the past 100 or so years of, or 200 or so years, depending on who they are, of discrimination done towards people who are marginalized, so to speak. So most of them would not admit that it's Marxist, but it's obviously, they have Marxist influences, obviously, but also not just Marxist influence, it's also postmodernist as well. So, you know, there's a lot of different ideologies that go into making DEI, not just Marxism. Most folks wouldn't openly admit it. Now, in their seminars, you may hear, and I know that you'll hear because I've seen it, you will hear attacks on capitalism. You will hear attacks on free enterprise and calling those things white supremacist systems. I mean, going back to American Express, you know, Coalition United, the group I work with, we did a campaign against American Express, and we evaluated their DEI programs. And they invited a speaker there to talk about how capitalism is racist. One of the largest companies in the world for credit cards and finance, you know, telling their employees that they're doing a racist, they're part of a racist enterprise by being capitalist. So no, DEI definitely shoehorns a lot of bad ideologies into it, but it's not just one ideology. It's a bunch of different things, and they will not admit that.
It's ironic that American Express had such a speaker on there to denounce capitalism, and that's kind of the whole basis of American Express is to be involved in capitalism. So who falls inside DEI and who gets excluded from it?
So those who are considered marginalized fall inside. So that would be, according to the current frame of mind, that would be black people, and that would be women, particularly women of color. That would be like non-cisgendered people. I mean, people who have preferences that go outside of heterosexuality. That means gay people, lesbians, that'd be transgender people, especially disabled people, a bunch of different kinds of people, biracial people, mixed people, any group that can be deemed marginalized under the current frame of thought in that movement, in that industry, would fall under DEI. And anyone who is not seen as marginalized and is instead seen as members of the dominant class, like white people and people who are, you know, heterosexual and straight or who are just male, those wouldn't be seen in a very very high light. In fact, there have been DEI seminars that I have seen that literally say, if you're a white person, be quiet when you're in the presence of a black person or a minority, because their experiences matter more than yours.
Wow. So if diversity is really the key there, do the promoters of this, would they see, you know, obviously they see it's perfectly okay to hire somebody solely because they believe they're a female when they're not, but would they object to hiring somebody solely because they're a devout Christian?
Well, it would depend on what variation of Christianity they represent. If that Christian happens to be a liberation theologist or someone who believes in that version of Christianity, I have a hard time believing that would be a mark against them. That most likely would be a mark for them. But if that person was a sort of conservative Christian in the vein of someone like, I don't know, Jerry Falwell Sr., that would definitely be a mark against them because they would be seen as perpetuating white supremacist and oppressive institutions.
Okay, let's go ahead and take a break there. Come back. We're going to have more with Christian Watson. We're talking about DEI today. That's diversity, equity, and inclusion. And coming up, we're going to be talking about its effect on the military. And welcome back. We're talking with Christian Watson, a spokesman for Color Us United and the host of Pensive Politics with Christian Watson. In his shows and writing, he offers a glimpse of what smarter politics might look like, and we're all for that. Today, we're talking with him about DEI, that's diversity, equity, and inclusion. He has a recent article in the Washington Examiner about the effects of DEI on our military, which we'll talk about in a moment. But before we do that, you know, we got so wrapped up in DEI and defining it and trying to get our heads around it that we totally skipped over your organization, Color Us United, whose mission is advocating for a race-blind America. So talk to us about your group.
So we are a 501c3 nonprofit, and our objective is, as our mission statement says, to inform, you know, American society about the principles of colorblindness. And what we mean by that is we mean a moral position that is not give undue significance to the skin color or the identity of someone, but instead recognizes them as individuals fundamentally and uses that as a basis to evaluate their behavior and evaluate their standing in society. And we believe this ideology is contrary to the viewpoints of people like Black Lives Matter and other groups that have really hijacked the race conversation and skewed it in the direction of collectivism and racialism and identitarianism. And so we exist as a bulwark against all those things to hopefully push Americans back to a more constitutionally minded and a more American, really, frame of thought. Because I say more American because the idea of an America, being an American, unlike most other nations in the world, where your idea of being a citizen of their nation has to do with your allegiance to the community, has to do with your ethnicity. The idea of being an American kind of broke the mold of thousands upon thousands of years of human civilization because it was no longer about your ethnicity or your family or your heritage or your inheritance. It was about a statement of principles that you held dear that are universal and endemic to the human experience. And so we wish to teach that. We wish to revive that because that is significantly lost in our culture these days.
Mm. You know, as you're talking there, I am reminded so much of that line from Martin Luther King's famous speech where he says, "I have a dream that my four little children will one day live in a nation where they will not be judged by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character." And it just seems we have marched so far away from that. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, that's part of it, I think, definitely. But I think even going beyond that, we should understand that for a lot of people, a lot of people identify their identity with their character. And that's a problem I don't think King really got. Malcolm X understood that. Not saying he was right. I don't think he was right at all. But Malcolm X, this is one of the reasons why there was actually this divide between Martin Luther King and Malcolm X. Because Malcolm X almost entirely identified character and virtue and strength in the beginning of his years with being black. Hmm. And a lot of people felt like that. Hmm. So we have to really ask ourselves, okay, where does that come from? And how do we get over that sentiment? And I think the answer is that's mostly an emotional sentiment that people use as a sort of a survival strategy or what they view as a survival strategy that goes all the way back to the basic instincts of human nature, that we should do our best to suppress with reason. So, yes, I think we have gotten far away from that in our culture. But even during King's day, there are people in his own camp who are also far away from that vision. It was a radical statement, a controversial statement, but it's a statement that we should heed nonetheless.
Yeah. Mm. So getting back to DEI, we especially wanted to talk to you about DEI's impact on the military. But whether it's the military or any organization, effectively hiring people based solely on some demographic rather than hiring people based on competence, skills, or experience and knowledge, that approach would just seem to weaken an organization, not strengthen it. Do I have that wrong?
That's correct. So when you forsake merit, you're undermining the integrity of an organization, you're undermining its future prospects, and you are also undermining the integrity of the subject that you are in. If you're in finance, someone can't count, they can't do basic calculations, and you're going to be in for a world of hurt should that rubber meet the road, as it will eventually. So that's correct. And really, when hiring preferences go beyond merit, they can easily slip into territory that we've seen happen under other circumstances. That territory is indeed things like nepotism and subjective preferences over objective metrics. Which we also don't need. Nepotism is not a good thing. You know, favoritism that is based on your personal tastes as opposed to someone's record is not a good thing, right? And this blinds you to reality. It blinds you to being able to see things for how they truly are. So for many reasons, this sort of disgrace of merit on the basis of equity is a shame. It's unfortunate, and it's a very dangerous prospect for institutions that are built upon achievement.
Well, certainly that applies to the military, and you have a great article on Washington Examiner that we're going to link up on iSpy Radio on today's show page. Just look for 13-19. Talk to our audience about the DEI in the military. Is it as bad as we hear? And what kinds of effects is it or will it have on our country's military readiness?
Well, unfortunately, I think that it is as bad as we hear. Many people, many reviewers may be acquainted with the situation that just happened, where a naval recruiter influencer was actually a drag queen and was doing that and to recruit people to the Navy. That's actually quite concerning because this active duty person who was doing this conveys a message about the military that is just not proper. The military is not about self-expression. The military is not about personal opinion. The military is about uniformity and pursuit of the defense of the nation. And whether you agree with that personally in your life or not, that is what a military needs to be able to sustain itself. So the damage that's happening is undeniable. The fact that there's been military recruitment is down at historical lows is undeniable, and it's unfortunate. And I don't think using an icon of the diversity, equity, and inclusion crowd to recruit people is a very surefire strategy that reinforces what the military should be about. It does the exact opposite. It undermines the institution. So I think that, you know, unfortunately, the military is in dire straits, and the political program that has been happening, not just with the drag queen, but also with the DOD and the Pentagon pushing woke ideals upon, you know, their soldiers, all that stuff is a danger.
Yeah, absolutely is. Okay, let's go and take a break a little bit early here, come back, we'll talk some more about DEI in the military, and also, how do we get past this? And welcome back. We're talking with Christian Watson about DEI, that's diversity, equity, and inclusion, the latest scheme dreamed up by people who continue to want to divide this country based on race. He's also the national spokesperson for Color Us United. If you're on Twitter, you can give him a follow at Official C. Watson, and we'll put links to all of that and his recent article about DEI in the military on today's show page on iSpyRadio.com. Just look for show 13-19. And one of the other questions I had for you there about the military in your article there, you mentioned in there that the military has been a means by which economically disadvantaged and minority races have been able to literally pull themselves up by their own bootstraps. And I love this line from your article, quote, "Unfortunately, DEI programs threaten to dismantle this model of success completely. It turns out that telling minority recruits the military is racist isn't very helpful in persuading those minorities to join it." And, you know, I suppose that shouldn't be surprising, but how ironic they're trying to push more people of different colors and whatnot and different ideologies into the military, but it's actually having the reverse effect. So what's going on there?
Yeah, absolutely. And so the bar point I was trying to make there is that when you undermine the integrity of the institution, you also undermine all of its benefits. For a very long time, the military has been a means by which people in the most dire states of poverty could go and work for their country and then for the rest of their life not have to worry about some of the things people in poverty have to worry about. It is one of the biggest wealth builders. It doesn't make you rich, but it can certainly make you financially secure and then give you the ability to pursue things in life that you want to pursue, which is one of the reasons why so many people go to the military. They get their college paid for depending on their degree. So that is an invaluable asset to so many people in America. That is an invaluable affirmation of the American dream. It is a pathway to pursue the American dream, well, one of many pathways, of course. You know, so I think that when you undermine the institution, you undermine that, and we shouldn't take that for granted. Because if the goal is equity, and if the goal is really equity, then you would think, under their frame, they would want to ensure that those who have the least would continue to have the chances to get the most. But this program, this DEI program, completely undermines that, and that's it's very unfortunate.
So there have been studies that show things like ESG, that's environmental, social, and governance, effectively DEI's corporate governance twin, simply don't work. Firms that embrace ESG tend to have lower returns and poor performance. Shareholders make less money for the price of being woke. And likewise, DEI and ESG hires at tech firms. Tech firms, of course, love this sort of thing. Those are usually the first to get fired when layoffs start happening. So when it gets right down to it, how does ESG or DEI benefit anyone, especially the people that it's supposed to be helping?
It benefits the people who are DEI coordinators who get to pocket six-figure salaries of a teaching political program under the banner of benevolence. That's what it benefits, just being quite honest about it. It doesn't benefit anybody. It destroys the integrity of the institution. It completely displaces workplace concerns. Workplace concerns should be concerned with actually doing the job they were hired to do, not pursuing politics. But it does enrich those. DEI is a multi-billion dollar industry. It definitely enriches those who pay for the seminars, pay for the trainings, who pay salaries for DEI coordinators. It enriches those very much. So we should understand that this is one big profit schema that many people in America are buying into, because there are a cultural sentiment among some quarters of society that this is what's needed to fix the problems we supposedly have. But I would submit to anyone who's listening right now, and I would submit to anyone who believes what I just said, that the problems that can be fixed in society are going to be fixed not by coordinators teaching you their political programs, not by pseudo-Marxism, not by irrational ideas. They're going to be fixed first and foremost by people rising up in their ability to reason, by enlightening themselves, by studying and researching and trying to figure out the best solutions to the problems that we face right now in America. In other words, you don't need a program. You don't need a coordinator. You don't need anyone but yourself and your own willingness to learn and grow to help combat the problems that America has right now.
Well, we have certainly seen that boycotts of woke companies does seem to be having an impact. But I love the fact that you don't need to be joining these organizations. You yourself can have these kinds of impacts. That's great. I had mentioned that these tech companies which do these ESG and DEI kinds of hires, they are usually the first ones to be fired when layoffs come because they're not really adding anything to the company. I mean, that kind of hire just sort of says that. You're here for your color or for your other demographics, gender or whatnot. I would think that if I was a person that was hired under those circumstances, that I think it would really deflate my sense of self-worth if I'm the first one fired because that's all I was adding to that company. Do you see signs of that?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I've seen minor signs of that. But unfortunately, I think that a lot of the people who get into companies on the basis of affirmative action or DEI, right now, as until corporations continue to cut back on that kind of behavior, they have job security. And that's unfortunate. That's unfortunate because it's a disservice to the people who get on affirmative action, disservice to the employees that DEI coordinator has job security. It's a disservice all around. You know, this is why Colorbridge United exists. We exist so we can channel the concerns of Americans about their institutions into a actionable solution to fix these problems, which is why I encourage your viewers to go to colorbridge9.org and learn more about our organization.
So I just think in some ways it's really sort of a self-fulfilling prophecy that says that there are victims of racism only to get fired, and then you've created victims based on their race. I mean, that's ironically not funny, but I just think the whole thing's very ironic that they are creating their own victims.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I think there's this phenomenon of self-victimization that goes on when it comes to these issues. We should check into that. We should look into that because that's it's one thing to actually be a victim of a particular thing. Another thing to victimize yourself by virtue of a Nazi's ideology and then use that self-victimization to demand things from other people. That's a form of coercion that is not acceptable in a free society, and it is certainly not acceptable in institutions that are built upon cooperation and goodwill amongst people. You know, when you have coercion undermining goodwill, you don't have a society. You have a warlike state. And unfortunately, our society is in a warlike state in many, many quarters. But in many other quarters, it's not in that state. In many other quarters, most Americans go along as normal. But they are getting besieged by these ideas in their workplaces and their entertainment and all, and they just don't want to deal with it. Most people don't want to deal with their politics and their sport.
No.
Or the politics in their workplace. So there's a lot of phenomenon going on here that we can really address, and we should address it.
Well, unfortunately, we are up against the clock with you. Christian Watson, he's the spokesman for Color Us United. You can find out more about them by heading to colorusunited.org. We'll link that up on ispyradio.com as well. Christian, this is great. I'd love to talk to you again in the future.
Me too. Thank you.
I'd like to welcome our second guest today, Jennifer Hammaker. She is a sixth-generation Oregonian whose family has a long history in natural resources, including fishing and the timber industries. She is the president of Oregon Natural Resources Industries, or ONRI, O-N-R-I, an organization dedicated to protect Oregon's natural resource industries and the people who work in them. Jennifer, it's great to talk to you.
Thank you for having me on today.
Yeah, absolutely. So most people know who know about ONRI know that it used to be part of Timber Unity. Would you like to address that parting of the ways or maybe this? What does ONRI do that Timber Unity does not?
ONRI is a member-owned and driven association. We are 501c6. Our mission is to protect, support, and defend natural resource jobs, families, communities, and businesses. And Timber Unity is a PAC. It's a political action committee. We are completely separate.
So from my own observations, ONRI seems more about impacting and motivating the natural resources grassroots, whereas Timber Unity seems more about interacting and influencing politicians. Is that a good way to think of the difference?
Yes, I would think so. I think Henri is, I don't think, I know, our mission, you know, what we want to do is connect Oregon, connect the natural resource people, connect the industries so that we are all talking. You know, the fishermen might not know what the farmers are going through, but they both have issues. They don't, maybe the farmers don't know what the ranchers are going through. The ranchers might not know what the, you know, loggers are going through, but we all have the same ideals and concerns. We don't want public overreach or, you know, government overreach, but we do want to raise our families and we want to be able to be, you know, sustain ourselves, be self-independent and make sure that we have, you know, our way of life protected.
Hmm. So Henri and its members are engaged in a fight right now with the Oregon Department of Forestry over an HCP, a habitat conservation plan.
Yes.
And there's an awful lot to unpack here, and we've already decided to make this a two-part show, so we're going to have you back next week as well. And we'll dig into this particular HCP in detail a little bit more and why it needs to be stopped in the next segment, but let's get some general understanding of it to start. Basically, what is an HCP and what is it supposed to do?
An HCP stands for Habitat Conservation Plan. A Habitat Conservation Plan is a way for the federal government to partner with the state government, in this case, in this Western HCP, so that the ESA, which is the Endangered Species Act, and the species that are listed on the Endangered Species Act are protected. So you get this thing called an incidental take permit. So if you take would be considered anything, it's not just harvesting of these species. Coho, you know, it's not just pulling coho out of, you know, fishing for coho, or you accidentally fall a tree and there's a spotted owl nest in it or whatever. This has to do with anything and everything to do with these species, their habitat, their breeding cycles, their the trees that they supposedly live in, the waters that they swim in, all of this kind of stuff. It protects all of it. And it goes further than just protecting them at this point. The ESA, the Endangered Species Act, has been abused. And right now we are trying to prove that in the federal court. The HCP uses the ESA to be able to protect these animals, protect these habitats, these critical habitats. However, I mean, I would like to see any kind of reports that show that any of these animals, species, have increased in numbers and populations having a HCP, you know, put around them. So
it just means it hasn't been around long enough, I guess.
Well, so actually the HCPs have been around in Oregon, especially since the 1990s when the spotted owl debacle happened.
Right. Yeah, yeah. I was being sarcastic there.
Oh, yeah. Well,
they just need to keep trying harder, in other words.
Right. They need to keep on locking up our forests because it's not working.
Hmm.
Yeah. And it's not.
This particular HCP that you're doing battle with over the Oregon Department of Forestry, why did they think they need this particular plan, and what are the alleged benefits they hope to get from it?
I don't know.
Hmm.
That's the short answer. I don't know. Hmm. I don't think they've articulated that. I don't think the Oregon Department of Forestry has articulated that, and I know that the Board of Forestry has not articulated that. I have asked them several, why are you doing this? What is the benefit to this? And basically what has happened is Kate Brown gave a directive to the Board of Forestry for more conservation in our forests. So the Board of Forestry, who controls or directs the Department of Forestry, directed the Department of Forestry to create an HCP that locks up 53% of our state forests and puts critical habitat. And, you know, it's called critical habitat. It's called habitat conservation areas and riparian conservation areas. Those areas are non-harvestable areas. You can't harvest a huckleberry off of them.
Hmm. As far as this particular HCP, did it arise at all from legislation? So the ODF has mandated to bring this about, or is this an administrative scheme that arose from within?
Well, so do you remember when the counties sued the state for greatest permanent value, and they won in the court,
right?
And then the state appealed it, and in the appeals court they lost, and then they brought it to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court said, well, no, we're not going to hear this.
Right.
Well, they were suing for the definition of greatest permanent value. And so there is a contractual duty for ODF, or Oregon Department of Forestry, and our state forester to harvest our lands. So back in the, before we were a state, people moved to the, you know, west side of the Cascades because we were abundant in everything. Forests, we had tons of fish and wildlife. People could live there. They had, you know, the trees to build their homes. They had the soil to grow things. They had the rivers filled with fish and all this kind of stuff, and deer and turkeys and all that kind of stuff, right? So that they flourished. Oh my God, this is heaven on earth. We love it. We're right here on the Pacific Ocean. It's gorgeous. We love it. And then the fires came through. Well, when they homesteaded on these areas, the counties were being created because the state was being created. And then when the forest fire came through and it wiped them all out, all these people packed up and left. And so the counties were left with all this land sitting around, and they're like, wait a second, we're not getting any tax revenue off of this. And we can't afford to manage these, you know, we don't own these. These are private properties. So they went to the Oregon legislature and they said, hey, can you guys manage these forests? And with whatever is pulled off of these forests as far as timber harvest revenue, will you, we'll give you the money off of that to offset your costs. We'll take the rest of the money and... but you manage these forests because we can't afford it and we don't have the manpower to do it. And so the state said, sure, we'll do that. So they replanted and it all grew back. Well, at that point, it was 17% of timber harvest revenue went to Oregon Department of Forestry.
Right.
To,
and that used to work really well. It generated billions of dollars over the years. It provided for school funds. It provided for roads and so many other services. And then the Oregon Supreme Court says, well, when we said it was a contract, it's not really a contract. And so we'll decide that.
Right.
And of course, they pulled that now. Okay, we do need to take a break. Everyone stay with us. We're going to be talking more about this habitat conservation plan that the Oregon Department of Forestry has schemed up. We'll do that more with Jennifer Hammacher from ONRI. It's a day of acronyms today. We're talking with Christian Watson about DEI. Now we're talking with Jennifer Hammacher, the president of ONRI, that's the Oregon Natural Resources Industry. And we're talking about an HCP, Oregon's Habitat Conservation Plan, hatched by the Oregon Department of Forestry. So Jennifer, we were talking during the break there, and this really, this new HCP that came up, it dates back to 2018.
Yep.
And at the time, the projections were it'd be maintaining the same amount of timber harvest and forests were going to be managed. Not just burning up, but then they changed it somehow. When did they change this? And I know you said that you don't know why, but was there any kind of impetus at all that would have kicked this over?
No. So what has happened is what they do with these habitat conservation plans, they call it modeling. So for example, right now in this habitat conservation plan, it says ODF has used the numbers 2 to 3 jobs per million board feet harvested will be lost. Okay. But in all actuality, industry uses 11 to 13 jobs per million board feet harvested, depending on the slope, what kind of equipment are going to be up there, all that kind of stuff. So when they go in to bid a job, they use 11 to 13. ODF put in 2 to 3. So right there, when they say, oh, you're going to only lose 923 jobs in Clatsop County, well, that's not true. Times that by about 4. So
it's kind of laughable that they think anybody believes government projections at this point. I mean, they are.
Right.
Are they ever right about anything? Oh, it's only going to cost $1 billion, and suddenly it's $10 billion.
Right, exactly. Well, and so and there's so many inaccuracies to this HCP, these projections and these modelings within the HCP that they have been called out and called out and called out. And finally, what has happened is they have gone back to the drawing board on some of these certain issues, and they've done it all behind closed doors, and they've also come up with a thing called an adaptive management plan that they've kept behind closed doors. So we really don't know what is going to be, you know, what the new projections are going to be, except for we got some information from Oregon Department of Forestry that is a They gave us better, broader, more articulated numbers. And those numbers show that there's going to be an additional 34% reduction on timber harvest.
Mm.
So this is raising a lot of red flags, because there was people that were for the HCP before, and now they're saying, oh no, oh no, oh no. We even know ODF staffers that are like, oh no, oh no, oh no. I guess not staffers, but people that work for ODF, but they can't say anything because they're going to lose their job if they do. So they're pushing this very hard.
So in terms of this smacks of a typical leftist environmentalist pipe dream, where they plan to push this through no matter who objects to it, no matter how strongly, mm-hmm. no matter how much input they get, they're still going to do it anyway. What are the deadlines to stop this?
Okay, so their next and final meeting that's going to be a public meeting, the Board of Forestry is holding on June 7th in Sisters, Oregon. We're trying to get a massive crowd there so that we make a big impression. So that's they were supposed to vote on it last September, but because we pushed so hard and showed so many inaccuracies within this HCP, they said, okay, we're going to go ahead and extend that timeline for a year. So this September, they're supposed to be voting on whether they're going to accept, reject, or hopefully pivot on this HCP, so that at least we get the same timber harvest levels that we were before, which means management of our forests. As you know, non-managed forests build up fuel, and so when it does spark off,
yes.
they're huge catastrophic wildfires.
Yep.
And the very species that are supposed to be protected under this HCP burn up.
Yep, that's exactly right. So to be clear, there's a meeting in June 7th in Sisters, but the vote on it won't be until September. Do I understand that correctly?
You understand that? Yes, correctly, yes.
So what can happen between June 7th and September to derail this?
Well, so we've come up with a strategy. We've got a 6-point strategy on bringing awareness to the public about threefold. Number one, benefits of forest management. Number two, the HCP. People are not aware of the HCP. Number three, the consequences of the HCP. It will cripple these 15 counties that depend on this timber harvest revenue. It will also cripple our environment, our air, our water, our wildlife, our forests, if this catches fire. And it will catch fire. This is a 70-year HCP. I'm 50 years old right now. I've got a 25-year-old daughter. Her great-grandkids, my daughter's great-grandkids, are still going to be dealing with this HCP.
Hmm. You had mentioned some of the consequences there, and the 70-year plan, is that, to me, that sounds completely out of the ordinary. Am I correct in that? I mean, what would a normal HCP be?
Well, so it varies. The Elliott had a 20-year HCP on it. They revamped it. They put another HCP on it. So it just varies. The private forest accord, that's a 50-year HCP on private forest land. So it just depends. The applicants are what set the amount of time that the HCP is going to be, enacted. So Oregon Department of Forestry usually harvests on an 80-year rotation. So they set this HCP up 70 years. Now, just using logic, I understand where they're coming from. They grow their trees 80 years old before they start thinking about harvesting them.
Hmm.
On private timberland, it's a little bit different. You know, usually for Doug fir, it's, 50, 60 years before they harvest them, and then they replant. And the thing is that our laws in Oregon are so strict. They're actually the strictest, most regulated laws of any industry in the United States of America. We have to plant 4 trees for every 1 harvested. Out of 300 beautiful growing trees in Oregon, we're only allowed to harvest 1.
Wow.
And every year we plant over 40 million trees. That's almost 10 trees for every man, woman, and child who lives in Oregon.
Yeah. Okay, let's go ahead and take a break there. We will be wrapping things up with Jennifer Hammacher talking about the habitat conservation plan that the Oregon Department of Forestry is trying to ram through. Stay with us.
Thank you.
And welcome back. We're in our final segment now with Jennifer Hammaker. She is the president of Oregon Natural Resources Industry, or ONRI, O-N-R-I. Talking about Oregon's disastrous habitat conservation plan. You can find out more about ONRI at onri.us, and we'll link that up on iSpyRadio.com as well. So getting back to this 70-year plan, is there any way out of this once it gets going, or is that going to somehow lock us in? Because it sounds like going into it, you've got some flexibility, but do you then lock things in and not be able to change it?
You know, I'm not sure about the specifics on that. I know that once an HDP is set and you make a contract with the federal government, that's what this is, by the way.
Right.
This is NOAA Fisheries. And yeah, so this is a contract between you and the federal government. They can come in and survey, they can come in and look at, they can come in and take samples of, they can come in and do whatever they want to prove that you are, meeting your contractual needs. So this is state land that this HCP is on, and they're inviting the federal government to come in and partner up with them. Hmm. To me, that is wrong. Oregon knows how to manage our forests. I don't know if you know this, but Oregon is the breadbasket of timber and lumber in the United States of America. We're the number one lumber, plywood, and cross-laminated timber in the United States, and they're shutting us down, and they continually shut us down.
Right, and what's so stupid about that is Oregon should be leading the world in terms of sustainability and all the rest that the left really wants us to do, but by shutting it down here in Oregon, it means you're going to be getting your wood and all the rest from some of these other countries that don't care about the environment. They're just going to go in and clear cut it and not care, because to them, the money is more important. And that's really one of the short-sighted aspects of this, I think, is that we should be setting the world standards here for that sort of thing. Let's show how this can be done and that it can be done sustainably. And yet we're offshoring all of this. As far as derailing this, I know that you guys have a petition out there that's OregonStrongerTogether.com. We'll link that up on iSpyRadio.com as well. People can sign that. Yeah. What are some of the other things people can be doing at this point?
Well, we have the petition going, which we want to gather at least 50,000 signatures and smack that down in front of Jim Kelly, who's the chair of the Board of Forestry, on June 7th in Sisters at the last public meeting that they're holding before they vote on this HCP. We also have a proclamation, several of them. There's 15 counties that are going to be impacted by this HCP. And directly impacted by this HCP.
Right.
And so we've written proclamations, ONRI has, and we've gotten them out to these counties. And so far, seven of them, actually, we've only written nine. We haven't written all 15. We've written nine of the most impacted counties. Seven of them have passed them through their Board of Commissioners. And so I'm working on the other two, Columbia and Washington. And we are going to present the proclamations in unity as a united stand against this HCP to the Board of Forestry during the June 7th Board of Forestry meeting. Mm. So hopefully that'll make an impact, along with the petitions. And then we are also putting together a media campaign, like I said, to educate the people about the HCP, the consequences of the HCP, and the benefits of forest management. There's a couple other things that we're doing that I don't want to publicly say, because I don't want the opposition to get wind of it. So, but we are working diligently and hard to make sure that the Board of Forestry knows exactly where we stand.
Are you taking donations to try to help some of your media efforts?
100%. Yes, please. So far, we have a media campaign that we're trying to fund, and it is rather expensive. ONRI does not make any money on this. All money that is going towards the media campaign to hopefully try to prevent the HCP goes directly towards the media firm that is handling the campaign. So yes, if you contact ONRI, you can contact me directly. You can go on our website and contact us, send us an email. We will respond. And yes, we are taking donations.
And again, that website is onri.us, and we'll put that up on iSpyRadio.com as well on today's show page. Look for 13-19. And so I'd like to, in the time that we have left, just dig into some of the impacts, some of which you've already touched on. In an email blast, you outlined some of these. You say this is going to affect 640,000 acres. Three lumber mills are already warning that they will close if this goes into effect. That's Hampton, Ferraris, and Stimson. It's going to drastically decrease timber harvest revenue to counties and taxing districts that depend on that revenue to provide critical public services. Are there other big impacts that you think we should highlight right now?
Well, I mean, so the Oregon's governor declared an emergency on housing. She wants to put, $200 million, I think, towards creating 36,000 more homes than we have been annually. That I can't even believe that she put that out there. That to me is ridiculous. Mm-hmm. However, not that it's ridiculous to build more housing. I think obviously we need it. I think the country needs it. However, that much housing is ridiculous, especially at the same time that you're closing down our forests. We are the breadbasket of the United States as far as timber and lumber goes. We should be getting our lumber to build houses right here. It's cheaper to do it. It doesn't take any carbon emissions to truck it across from Russia or down south or over in Maine where the other breadbaskets are. We can do it right here, but we cannot do it if you keep on closing down our forests. So to me, it's a contradiction.
Well, it's a triple whammy because you're taking forests offline that were producing revenue for the state. You now have to replace that revenue from somewhere, and you're spending money to manage those forests when you could have been making money off of them. Unfortunately, we're up against the clock here with you, Jennifer. We will be talking to you more about this next week.
Okay. Thank you so much for having me on.
Be sure to join us next week as we continue to unravel this disastrous plan for our forests. Next week, we'll be digging into the personal impacts this will have. You only do this sort of thing if you don't actually care about the forests or the people who make their living from the forests or the public institutions like schools and county governments that get their funding from those people earning their living. You only do this sort of thing if you truly do not know how money is created. And yes, I have just accurately described the bureaucrats at the Oregon Department of Forestry. You can donate to help Henri fight this. Head to onri.us, onri.us, and at the top of the page under the shop tab, there is a link to donate. If you missed that, head to iSpyRadio.com and the links will be on today's show page 13-19. Don't just sit there and let it happen when you could take action. Because as we say every week, the best information does you no good if you don't use it. Reagan, what do you think?
I do not believe in a fate that will fall on us no matter what we do. I do believe in a fate that will fall on us if we do nothing.
It's more than a show. It's self-defense. The I Spy Radio Show.